Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Why do smart people do stupid things? This is a question asked by Lawrence Gonzalez, author of Deep Survival, Who Lives, Who Dies, and Why, and Everyday Survival, Why Smart People Do Stupid Things. In these books, Lawrence Gonzalez examines the mental scripts we all follow as we live our lives, and how these scripts prescribe our response to a situation based on our past experiences. The problem is that sometimes these scripts result in wrong and possibly dangerous actions based on insufficient or imagined evidence. Gonzalez's work demonstrates how these scripts can sometimes lead us to being our own worst enemy. To break this cycle and encourage full understanding of a situation and wise decision-making, Gonzalez encourages curiosity, awareness, and attention. He writes, "Those are the tools of our everyday survival. We all must be scientists at heart, or be victims of the forces that we do not understand." In this, the first of a two-part Radio Curious visit with Lawrence Gonzalez, we discuss how our mental scripts are created both genetically and from our personal experiences. I spoke with Lawrence Gonzalez from his home near Chicago, Illinois, on January 19, 2009, and began by asking him how human behavior today has been shaped by that of our ancestors many thousands of years ago. Lawrence Gonzalez, welcome to Radio Curious.
Thank you.
In your books, Everyday Survival and Deep Survival, you trace our ability to get along, our being Homo sapiens now in the 21st century. You trace that back to what we learned 50, 60,000 years ago on the savannas of Africa, both before and after that. Can you bring some of the behavior that our species learned at that time forward to the way we as human beings live now?
Yes. One of the things that we did, and it goes back even farther than that, perhaps millions of years rather than tens of thousands, is that we constantly tinkered with things. There's a long history in the fossil record of people picking things up just because they were curious and manipulating them with their hands and figuring out novel uses for them or figuring out ways to alter them for new uses. And this, even though other animals used tools, the way we did it was an order of magnitude different from the way animals use tools. We were the first species, really, that sort of rejected our own environment and said, wait a minute, I can make an environment of my own. And this is an extremely significant thing to us today because we were successful at doing it. And we actually created an environment that allowed us to ignore the environment we came onto this earth in and to live in one that didn't exist before. And this had both good and bad effects. It protected us from predators, and it supplied our needs, and keeps us warm, and all of that good stuff.
Well, going back into the time frame that you're drawing from, how did we live then?
Let's take 50,000 years ago. Probably there is not much record of things like clothing, because they're perishable. But I'm inclined to believe that we had clothing. There are many kinds of tools that would have perished, too, if they were made of wood or other organic materials and not rock or bone. But we were just beginning to get to the stage where we could create this kind of new environment that I'm talking about. So going back, say, 30 to 40,000 years, you find cave art, which indicates that these people had a life that was completely different from the human beings that went before. They had a symbolic life. And from the symbolic life, we were able to create what we now know as a technological society. It's a life in which you can imagine things that don't exist and create them. So the way people lived then, they were just beginning to think that way and behave that way. Prior to that, people made tools, and they lived, probably a lot of them lived without clothing and without complex tools. And so it was basically a hand-to-mouth existence. You know, they hunted, and they ate what they hunted right then, and when it was gone, they had to hunt again. So that was our way of life then. But this tinkering instinct is something I talk about quite a bit in Everyday Survival, because it led not only to the material things we have, but to language.
So bringing that forward to our lifetime now, what are the strings, what are the elements that follow?
Well, the elements that follow in terms of the tinkering instinct that I'm talking about are the amazing diversity of stuff that we have around us that we have made, so that people are constantly inventing things. I mean, our culture, and I'm speaking here of my culture, which is the United States, but this is true of lots of cultures, East and West, North and South, is a culture of making stuff. And we make this stuff and we trade it with other people, and that forms the basis of our culture. So this instinct runs throughout the history of people, all the way back, I would say, at least a couple of million years.
But in our culture now, you seem to indicate in Everyday Survival that we're not quite as curious as we were in the past.
Well, that's what I started to say about the artificial environment that we created. There are good things about it, but there are bad things about it, too. One of the drawbacks of it is, by providing us with all of the things we need and keeping predators away from us, it gives us the illusion that we don't really have to do anything. You know, we get fed every day no matter what stupid things we do. And often in the talks that I give, I talk about Socrates, because Socrates thought that writing and reading were a bad idea, and in fact taught that was not a good way to learn, because if you have people who are able to write and read, then you lose the ability to memorize all the things you need to memorize to learn in the way that he learned. And you also lose the ability to question the person who's saying something, because the text can't be questioned. And so all sorts of pernicious nonsense gets purveyed through writing and reading. And the truth was, he was right. What he didn't say was that there was a great benefit to writing, too, and you could expand human knowledge with it. So each of these new technologies comes with a cost. And in the case of our overall culture that we live in, one of the costs is we're not very curious about the world around us. We don't have to be. It's not necessary for survival. So it kind of makes us stupid in some ways, and it makes us very vulnerable in some other ways.
The subtitle to your book, Everyday Survival, Why Smart People Do Stupid Things, is linked to your use of the word stupid. What are some of those things that we stupidly do, not knowing that we're doing them?
Well, I give a number of examples in the book, and the examples start off with an explanation of how everything we do becomes gradually automated, because animals tend to be efficient. They tend to be efficient because the ones that were efficient were the ones that survived and were able to breed and continue the species. So it's selected by, you know, Darwinian selection makes these things, the ones that we end up with as those who inherited these traits. So, for example, we make mental models of things in the world so we don't have to figure out these things. Once you see one shoe, you know, you'll recognize all shoes. Once you've seen one dog, you'll recognize all dogs. Not because you have seen every breed of dog in the world, but because you have a very simplified model of a dog stored in your memory. And these mental models make it possible to recognize things like caricatures, where you just have a few lines and you say, oh, yeah, that's Theodore Roosevelt. That wouldn't work if you didn't make simplified mental models in your head. So this is a form of automation. It's an efficient thing that allows you to move around quickly in the world. We also automate our behaviors. Anything you do repeatedly, you can begin to do without thinking, such as tying your shoe.
Or driving a car.
Driving a car. Most people can drive without thinking. That's why they can talk on a cell phone. And it's not safe to do that, but people do it. And pretty successfully, given the demands of how complex driving is. So we automate all these things in our lives, and the trick is not to be on autopilot all the time, but to actually think about what you're doing. I use an example of Lynn Hill, who was a famous rock climber, who was starting out to climb a cliff, and she was tying her rope to her harness, and in the middle of this, she was interrupted and talked to somebody, and then she knelt down, tied her shoe, and went and climbed the cliff face, and when she leaned back to rappel down, she fell 72 feet because her rope hadn't been tied to her harness. So she had this behavioral script for tying her rope that was very familiar, and she had another behavioral script for tying her shoe, which was also very familiar and very similar to the one for tying her rope to her harness. So her brain became satisfied that it had done what was necessary when she tied her shoes. So because she wasn't paying deliberate attention to each step of this process, she just had the feeling that she'd finished and she went ahead and climbed. So this is an example of how these automations can trip us up.
Well, it seems to me there's two factors there that I'd like us to bring out in this conversation. One is when we learn something or we have an initial or primary experience, that forms the foundation or the basis against which we compare all subsequent experiences.
Right.
And the other is what is developed into checklists, for instance, in flying an airplane. No matter how many times the pilot has flown it, they use a checklist.
Right.
In your book, Everyday Survival, you talk about the problems that occurred in the American Airlines flight that crashed in New York City in November of 2001. And I'd like you to compare that fatal crash, to the crash that occurred in New York City on January 15th of 2009, where the pilot was able to land in the Hudson River and everybody survived.
In the American Airlines crash, the plane ran into the wake of another airplane, which is a turbulent area behind a plane. When it's flying, it sets up a wake like a boat does. And when you run through it, it jostles your plane. There's really generally nothing terribly dangerous about it if the planes are both of the same size. It's like two big boats going past each other. But the pilot in the case of the American crash had somehow developed a fear of wake turbulence. And I actually believe he had a fear of flying, but there's no way to know that. When he hit the wake turbulence, he jammed the rudder with his foot back and forth so forcefully that it broke the tail of the plane off. It broke the part of the rudder that moves off. And the plane lost its steering and went into the ground. He had done this same thing on a couple of other occasions, so it was clear from the record that he had developed this inappropriate behavioral script for responding to a certain kind of upset in an airplane, and he had not examined it thoroughly enough, and the people around him had not stopped him from doing it effectively. And so he just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time and did that wrong thing, and it crashed the plane. So he had some real, I would say, emotional issues to deal with that were never dealt with.
And in the U.S. Airlines flight of January 15th of 2009, where the engines were shut off by birds flying into them, they were successful for other reasons.
Yeah. Well, the case is almost, in terms of the pilot, is almost the exact opposite. The pilot of the U.S. Airways flight, from all reports, was a guy who was under a lot of emotional control. He was a guy who didn't fluster. He wasn't afraid of flying. He was very expert at it. And he didn't have any sort of emotional reactions that he didn't know about, if I'm reading the record correctly. So when this thing happened, which is like the worst possible thing that can happen to you when you're departing in an airliner, both engines go out, you're only at 3,200 feet, there aren't too many choices. This is a very bad situation. And I have to say, most airline pilots would behave correctly. So this guy just stayed calm, He looked at his options. He saw that he couldn't make it either back to LaGuardia or on across the river to Teterboro in New Jersey. And he said, I'm putting it down in the river. He actually said, I'll be in the river to the air traffic controller. And he did an amazing job. I mean, there were lots of obstacles. It's a busy river. There were bridges. And he put it down right where it needed to be and did a perfect landing. So he was kind of your textbook pilot. He was the guy you want to have flying your plane when you're on an airliner.
Well, Lawrence Gonzalez, I'd like you to extrapolate from those two incidents and explain what we can learn from that in our daily lives. But first, I'd like to say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Lawrence Gonzalez, author of Everyday Survival, Why Smart People Do Stupid Things, and the author of Deep Survival, Who Lives, Who Dies, and Why. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. So, Lawrence, what do those two parallel airline accidents teach us? What can we learn from them?
Well, one of the things that we can learn is that it's very important to pay more attention to how you behave in everyday life. Because, for example, the captain of the U.S. Airways flight didn't suddenly start behaving the way he behaved on the day that he lost his engines. He'd been behaving that way his whole life. He's a guy in his 50s, I believe. So he had had, a 29-year career as a pilot. He had been a fighter pilot in the Air Force. So he'd had a lot of time to practice this way of behaving. You can look at, for example, you can look at the way someone behaves in a traffic jam. If you see someone in a traffic jam who's pounding the steering wheel and yelling and blowing his horn, you're seeing someone who hasn't led a very examined life. You're seeing someone who doesn't realize that he's emotionally out of control. And this is not someone you would want to have with you in a hazardous situation. This is someone who doesn't know how to stay cool and do the next right thing. So when we look at our own behavior, we can fairly easily monitor how we behave in small crises, small challenges, which come up every day, and just see, you know, how are we feeling? How are we behaving? Are we doing the most efficient thing? And then we can extend this later when we run into some kind of big trouble, because we always do, and it will come out as the behavior that we're used to doing, because people do what they practice doing. When you have an emergency, what you find is that your true nature comes out. So whatever you've been practicing doing, it's going to happen when you're challenged in an emergency. And especially if you're under a lot of stress, you don't have time to invent new strategies at that point. You're going to fall back on the ones you've been using. So I give an example in my talks of an FBI agent who had trained himself to snatch a gun out of someone's hand. And he worked with a partner, and they did it over and over and over, and pretty soon he became really good at snatching a gun out of someone's hand. And sure enough, one day he's on the street, and some bad guy comes up and sticks a gun in his face, and he snatched the gun out of the guy's hand. And then he handed it back to him. Now, the reason he did this was because that's how he and his partner had practiced it. What he hadn't thought of was that final step of handing it back was not something he wanted to have in his emotional repertoire when a real bad guy appeared.
Probably surprised that bad guy quite a bit.
Surprised him so much that the FBI agent's partner had time to shoot him. But you see what I'm getting at, that we practice, the behavior we get in an emergency is the behavior we practice. And so we have to pay more attention to how we're behaving in day-to-day life, because that's what's going to come out.
So you draw the lack of attention being behaved in our day-to-day life in a number of different areas. One of them, you suggest that we, those of us living in this time, in this era, are not as curious as our ancestors were.
I believe that's true. We don't have to be. Our ancestors had to be very curious about everything around them all the time because, first of all, it could be very dangerous, and secondly, it could be very useful. So, you know, somebody had to eat the first mushroom, and somebody had to dig up the first potato, and you don't do that unless you're curious about stuff and unless you're always tinkering with things. We don't have to do that. really everything is supplied to us. And so it's really a challenge to be curious, and it's a challenge to look at your world in a new way. The familiar things you see around you all the time are really very interesting, but most people never look at them. And most people don't even have, they don't even understand when you tell them to be curious what you're talking about. I tell a story about an experience I had in California some years ago. I was driving across the Rockies from east to west, and I spent all day driving up this mountain, driving and driving and driving all the way up to the top of this mountain. And then I spent the whole afternoon driving down and down and down and down this mountain, and at the very bottom of the mountain there was a gas station, and I pulled in, and the guy was there filling my tank. And I said, "What's the name of that mountain?" And he said, "What mountain?" And I was like, "What?" You know, this there's this one huge mountain sitting right next to his gas station. And, you know, he doesn't notice it because he lives next to it. And I think much of what's in our world is like that. I mean, everybody's got an iPod, right? But I bet you you couldn't find one person in 1,000 who could tell you how it works. What is inside that little, pretty little box? We don't know. It's a mystery. It's a total mystery.
So you characterize that as the vacation state of mind.
Right. I ran into this park ranger in a little tiny state park in near Nag's Head, near Kitty Hawk, where the Wright brothers first took flight. And it's called Jockey's Ridge State Park, and it's these huge sand dunes that form between the land and the Atlantic Ocean. A very pretty place, but very small. It's a quarter mile wide. It's about a mile long. And I thought, I'll bet people can get into trouble even in this tiny little area. And I asked this park ranger. He said, "Oh, yeah, they come here in a vacation state of mind. They think the old rules don't apply, like gravity, because they're on vacation." And then he proceeded to tell me, you know, some of the more remarkable failures of thinking that he had experienced there. And I extrapolate this concept of the vacation state of mind because our culture makes it as if we're always on vacation because we get everything handed to us.
Food, clothing, transportation.
Yeah, anything we want all the time. And don't forget that people and animals learn by a system of rewards and punishments. So, you know, if you are a little kid and you touch a hot stove, you learn not to touch the stove again. And if you're a little kid and somebody gives you a cookie, you learn the cookies are good and you ask for more. So we move toward the things that please us and we move away from the things that hurt us, and gradually we become effective survivors in the environment. But in our environment, we get rewarded no matter what we do. So every day we get up and there's a pot of coffee and there's orange juice and eggs and so forth and so on, and the message we're getting is, hey, my strategy must be good because look at this, I'm getting rewarded, even if we're doing something really dumb. And so I'm not suggesting that we should change our culture so that we live in the wilderness again, but I'm saying that it takes an effort of mind in this kind of culture to keep yourself sharp for when something does happen. And something always does happen. You know, for those people on that U.S. Airways plane, these were just ordinary folks like you and me going on a short flight to Charlotte, and look where they ended up.
In the river.
In the river.
Alive.
And, you know, they weren't like people who went out thrill-seeking. They were just on an airliner. But it's going to, you know, it comes to everyone eventually. It may be, you know, a loved one that gets sick. It may be that you lose your job in the recession. You know, it could be anything, but there's going to be a challenge out there somewhere that you're going to have to face. You know, your parents are going to get old and die. Maybe you get cancer. Who knows? But there's something always out there. And the question that I always ask is how are you preparing for this now? What are you doing in your life to prepare for this? Or are you just going to let it happen?
And how do you answer that question?
I answer the question really by the simplest of all things, which is pay attention. And one of the reasons that the book Everyday Survival is structured the way it is because if you read it, it forces you to think about things that you may never have thought of before for your average reader. It talks about things like how the cosmos works, how the laws of physics work, where life may have come from originally, These are deep questions that most people don't think of and that most people aren't exposed to. But once you're exposed to those ideas, you can't get them out of your head. They're in there. And by being aware of things like that, like how your world works and how the universe works, it changes the way you think. And I think that that is part of changing the way you behave.
Well, Lawrence Gonzalez, I'd like to thank you for being with us on this part one of our interviews about your books, Everyday Survival, Why Smart People Do Stupid Things, and Deep Survival, Who Lives and Who Dies and Why. So as we close this first part, I'd like to ask you the two closing questions, one being, can you tell us something important or critical that you've learned recently?
Yes, it has to do with a state of mind that people go into when they're deeply involved in some sort of activity. In particular, I've been reading about the arts and sciences. And when artists such as writers are doing their best work, or when scientists like Einstein are doing their best work, it seems that they go into an altered state of consciousness. And only recently have neuroscientists been able to start to explain how this works in the brain, and so I'm finding some very interesting things about the artistic process that I'm actually writing about now.
Well, perhaps we can get into that in our next program, but before we get there, can you tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately?
Yes, I read a book called Proust and the Squid, which is a title that I don't much like, by Marianne Wolfe, and the subtitle is The Story and Science of the Reading Brain. And it is about how people learn to read and how that makes changes in the brain. And she talks especially about children. And it's very, very interesting and connected with the idea that I was just telling you about.
Well, Lawrence Gonzalez, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
You're quite welcome.
Lawrence Gonzalez is the author of Deep Survival, Who Lives, Who Dies, and Why, and Everyday Survival, Why Smart People Do Stupid Things. The book he recommends is Proust and the Squid, The Story and Science of the Reading Brain by Marianne Wolfe. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $14 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org, and the phone is 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.